Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore, The Cellar, Roar, Scrat Tales, and It's the Small Things, Charlie Brown. I'll also be talking about the news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Spider-Man No Way Home on Blu-ray. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@themovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The one piece of news is a little bit of a straggler from last week, and it's a final wrap-up about the Will Smith kerfuffle. The reason it didn't get reported last week for me is because the news came in after I wrapped the show, but the Academy of Motion Pictures, Art, and Sciences met and decided that they're going to, in addition to Will Smith having resigned from the Academy, they are going to bar him from the Oscars for 10 years. He can't be a presenter, he can't win an award. He can't come to the ceremony. And that's fair, I think. You know, he went up on stage and punched somebody or hit somebody. So hopefully that's the end of it. I'm tired of talking about Will Smith. Let's talk a little bit about the box office from last weekend, because there's some interesting things that go on. I know that most people, just everyday life, they don't think much about the box office. They'll hear when a movie does the best and wins. Like last week, Sonic the Hedgehog, it did absurdly well. It did better than the original movie, which came out right before the pandemic. So this movie actually is doing better in the pandemic than its first film did. It made $72 million, which is very, very good. And what that to me says, it shows that people are returning to the theaters for sort of the event films. You know, the movies people want to see, as dumb as that sounds, the movies people want to see, they're returning to theaters for. It used to be, you know, 5-10 years ago and earlier, people would just go to the movies just for a night out. Now they're going to see specific movies that they want to see, which is why you're seeing such a disparity among the movies that are coming out. That's why you're only seeing a handful of them being big ones, like, you know, The Batman or Uncharted, which did unprecedentedly well. You know, and Morbius, and well, like, Morbius is an interesting story. It dropped like over 70% from weekend to weekend, which is a catastrophic drop for what should be a popular superhero movie. That's more along the lines of a horror movie or a horror movie sequel. And that makes sense because that's essentially what Morbius is. But if you track it day to day, The Lost City, which made less in its opening weekend, had sort of caught up day to day. So it's going to end up making more in the long run, I think The Lost City will, than Morbius. And that just shows the strength of counter-programming, but it's essentially, you know, for women and girls' night out type stuff, versus Morbius, which is still just struggling to try to be the Marvel movie that it just has the name for. Now, what's also interesting is Ambulance died. Ambulance didn't even make $10 million, which is pathetic. I think it's the lowest grossing Michael Bay movie on record in terms of opening weekend. I think even The Island, which is a notorious flop for him, scored more its opening weekend. And this is what's interesting. This is why you can't judge stuff by film Twitter. There are a lot of millennials out there, a lot of millennial writers who grew up with Michael Bay movies. They grew up, you know, when they were kids, they went and saw Bad Boys and they saw The Rock and maybe even Armageddon. And so then by the time they're in their 20s and he started making the Transformers movies, it was all sweet spot nostalgia for them. And there's a great love for Michael Bay in that generation. But that's just not enough to drive his movies, because this is not off base for Michael Bay. Because you take Transforming Robots out of his filmography, his box office isn't that good. I mean, following Pearl Harbor, he had stuff like The Island, which flopped. He had Pain and Gain that did okay, but it wasn't a huge hit. And he did 13 Hours, which I think is probably his best film, in my opinion. That one didn't do tremendously well either. If it didn't have Transformers in it, he wasn't making a lot of money. And even then, he ran the Transformers franchise into the ground to the point that the last movie, which still made hundreds of millions of dollars worldwide, was considered actually a loss for the studio. So these writers, these millennial writers and critics trying to justify how awesome Michael Bay is, they're falling victim to what I call the Goonies effect. It goes back to the movie The Goonies, which came out in 1985. Like, the kids who watched that movie in heavy rotation in the late 80s, early 90s on HBO, because it was on all the time, they love The Goonies. And objectively, The Goonies isn't that good of a movie. But the nostalgia associated with it is off the charts, because a lot of these kids grew up with that. I feel the same way about Indiana Jones, and I feel the same way about Star Wars. That's what I grew up with. Finally, if you want to look down a list, Everything Everywhere All at Once did really quite good. I mean, it made $6 million over the weekend, which isn't bad for a movie that size. That kind of a movie making $6 million is a huge hit. I mean, it is an obscure art house film, and don't expect it, because it's a multiverse movie, to bring in the numbers that Spider-Man did, because it's not going to. Don't listen to film Twitter on this. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to talk about is Kids in the Hall Season 6, which is coming to Prime Video on May 13th.
Well, the curse is lifted and the kids are back.
Guys, I knew we should have cryogenically frozen our bodies.
Well, who's financing this time? The devil again?
Well, sort of. Amazon.
Are you crazy?
You know what Amazon wants from Kids in the Hall?
Yes, Don, a funny show, but one that is free of targets. Topical topics.
It's all a government conspiracy.
Alarming edginess or unsettling settings.
So sorry.
I've opened a can of worms, haven't I?
Speaking of stuff you grew up watching, Kids in the Hall ran from, I think, 1989 to 1995. And I watched it all through college. My sister was a huge fan, and she got me turned on to the show. It's great sketch comedy. It's absurd, surreal sketch comedy. So unlike something like Saturday Night Live, which relies too much on topical things that it doesn't live outside of its moment. Kids in the Hall, you can watch now, and it's just as absurd. So they've brought it back. Now, you know, all the jokes of the old guys in the hall, because these guys are about 60 years old on average. But it's nice to see them come back. They did Death Comes to Town, which was a 6-part series that aired on IFC, you know, a dozen or so years ago. But it's nice to see them back and doing their sketch comedy. And what's nice is that you can go on Prime and watch the early episodes of Kids in the Hall. You can also watch it on IFC or any of those bundled services. The problem is they censor it. They take out anything that uses the F word. No, not that F word. The other F word. You get the uncensored versions on Prime Video. So if you're a Kids in the Hall fan or you want to catch up, that's the place to go. The next one that I want to highlight is coming to Netflix on May 27th, and that is Stranger Things Part 4.
I relocated you guys far from Hawkins because I thought you'd be safe. A war is coming. I'm afraid your friends at Hawkins are very much in the eye of the storm. Without you, we can't win this war.
This looks great. I mean, I think that the Stranger Things series has gotten better with each subsequent season. I thought the first season was really interesting, but it really took some time to get its footing. The second season, I think, was more cohesive. The third season, I thought, was off the rails. I loved it. I loved a lot of the things they did because they're really exploring the characters. I'm curious to see where they're going with Stranger Things Part 4. Now, they're splitting it up in two parts. The first part is being dropped all on May 27th, and then the second part's going to be dropped on July 1st. So you're going to be having more Stranger Things coming out throughout the summer. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Scrat Tales, and it's the small things, Charlie Brown. and welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. This segment is going to be about kids stuff. We're going to have some fun here. Take me back to my childhood. Everyone else got taken back to their childhood with stupid Michael Bay movies and Goonies. Let's talk about some fun cartoons. Well, the first one really isn't from my childhood. The first one is a spinoff of the Ice Age movies. And the Ice Age movies started, what was that, around 2000? It was about 20 years ago that series started. But this is Scrat Tales. It's on Disney Plus because Ice Age was originally a Fox property, and now that it's bought by Disney and Disney owns it, they're using the Blue Sky Studios as another animation arm. Scrat, the saber-toothed squirrel from the Ice Age movies, gets 6 new short films on Disney Plus in which he takes care of a baby. Aww. There are 6 episodes of this. They're 4 minutes each. So they're pretty quick. It reminds me a little bit of, there were these short films with Olaf from Frozen, the little snowman. And they were like him redoing the Disney movies, but they were like 2 or 4 minutes long each. So, I mean, you can burn through this whole thing in about a half hour. And this is really made for kids. Now, I've always said, when it comes to the Ice Age movies, I would watch an entire movie about Scrat. I'm less interested in the mammoth and the sloth and all the other ancillary characters that have been added over the years. Give me a 2-hour epic of Scrat chasing his acorn around the world, and I would be there for every minute of it. And I get it. There's not a whole lot of depth of plot or anything. This is like doing a Roadrunner movie on Looney Tunes. I mean, there's really not much to the characters. It's just a bunch of gags. But I love Scrat, and I've always loved Scrat. In fact, I would love to see a movie where you spend all your time with Scrat following him around, and every now and then you swerve into, like, in the background, there's maybe a plot going on, but it's very simple. But then very soon you get swept away with whatever Scrat's doing, and then you catch up with them, and you get, like, a 2-minute wrap-up in the background while Scrat's trying to dig a hole or something, and then he goes off and does something. I'd love to see that. I'd watch that. I think that'd be better than most of the Ice Age movies they've made. But anyways, these Scrat Tales are very cute because it's got a little baby Scrat to it. And they don't explain where the baby Scrat came from. And I get the sense that this is not his baby, even. That he just sort of stumbles upon this. They don't go into the biology behind the reproduction of saber-toothed squirrels, which didn't exist, by the way. But he's got this conflict between, you know, the innate nature to protect a child of his species balanced with the insane drive to get his acorn. And you end up with some very slapsticky Looney Tunes type thing. I mentioned Roadrunner and the Coyote. They have one episode where it's all about him trying to put together essentially an Acme device, although Acme didn't exist back during the Ice Age. But they're fun little things. Like I said, they're 4 minutes long, and I'm saying they're 4 minutes from beginning to end. That includes the credits. So these shorts are like maybe 3 minutes, maybe just a hair beyond that. So they're pretty short. They go pretty quickly. But they're a lot of fun, and if you've got kids in the house who love this kind of stuff, it's worth checking out. I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, you listen to that trailer, and I mean, he doesn't say anything in English, but you know what's going on in the trailer just by all the noises he makes. So I'm going to say that Scrat Tales totally rock.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next kid's show I want to talk about is It's the Small Things, Charlie Brown. On the day of the neighborhood baseball championships, Sally won't let Charlie Brown's team take the field because she is protecting a dandelion that has sprouted from the pitcher's mound.
Yay!
Aww! Sally?
Why, hello, little flower. Do you ever feel like you just don't fit in?
Small guys like us, we ought to stick together.
Can you move, please? Today's the championship game.
I'm not moving. I made a promise to protect her.
Join us for the sitting on the mound. Tell your friends.
You'll never be lonely again.
Now, if you recall, Apple TV Plus got the rights to the Peanuts TV series, all the specials, you know, Charlie Brown Christmas, Easter Beagle, Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, all that stuff. They've got all the specials on there, and they've started several Snoopy shows. They had like Snoopy in Space. And part of this is, again, this gets me right in the feels. This gets me right where the nostalgia was. I remember the excitement that we felt as kids whenever they were going to air a Peanuts special on TV. And you got to remember, you know, by the time, you know, you get to the 80s, we had VCRs. But back in the 70s, they existed, but only the really, really rich people had them. And some of them were like reel-to-reel VCRs. You didn't have cassettes back then. So the home use of VCRs didn't really explode until the 80s. When they were going to air it, you had one shot to watch it. You had to turn on the TV at 8 o'clock at night on whatever day, and that's your chance. That's the, if the power went out, tough crap. If there was a tornado and they preempted it to talk about the weather, tough crap. If you went to the bathroom and didn't get back before the commercial was over, you missed it. You could not pause or rewind it. And there was no internet to pull it up later. So you had one chance a year to watch the Easter Beagle or the Great Pumpkin or It's Christmas Time, Charlie Brown. And this was a big deal. And I remember how much fun it was to watch these. I mean, because at a young age, I'd watch them and I loved them. And Apple TV Plus has been doing a handful of Peanuts episodes. And one of the things I appreciate is they never have tried to update this too much to modern style. They use computer graphics and shading, and they have some little more complex animation, especially compared to something like It's Christmas Time, Charlie Brown, which I think was the very first one they ever did in the 50s. The style and the design, it still looks like the old Charles Schulz drawings of Peanuts. They didn't make them trendy. They didn't make them wear different clothes. You know, they didn't redesign everybody. You have that authentic look to them. And so you watch this thing now, and it really evokes what it was like to watch it as a kid, because it looks very similar and it connects with you on almost a subconscious level. And it's a sweet little story because, you know, the Peanuts, they're just a bunch of kids. So they don't care about politics or anything like that. They worry about the fact that they have a baseball game coming up. And this coincides with both opening day. You know, of course, we had baseball season starting, and it coincides with Earth Day. So it kind of hits both those fronts. But ultimately, it's a bunch of kids, and the kids want to play baseball. And then you have some kids who are like, oh, no, let's take care of this flower, which is just a dandelion. It's just a weed. But a five-year-old like Sally's going to look at it very differently. And then they have a musical interlude in the middle of it with uses a Ben Folds song, which is very sweet and very catchy. And they do some neat stuff with the animation, so it looks a little more retro, but it's not completely retro. But it looks like one of these interludes that they would have had back when they were originally making the productions, like when they did the old Red Baron bit with Snoopy in one of the earlier specials. So yeah, It's the Small Things, Charlie Brown is really sweet, and it's about 40 minutes. It's absolutely something you can watch with your kids, and you know, it makes me want to go back and watch some other stuff. Maybe go check out It's the Easter Beagle, Charlie Brown, which should be floating around there as well on Apple TV Plus. So I'm going to have to say It's the Small Things, Charlie Brown totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore, and The Cellar. To Feck Eyes at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore. First of all, before I forget, could you imagine 30 years ago just throwing that name out somewhere? Nobody would understand what the heck you were talking about. And the previous one, The Crimes of Grindelwald, Fantastic Beasts, The Secret of Dumbledore. Albus Dumbledore joins forces with Newt Scamander to thwart the rise to power of the dark wizard, Garrett Grindelwald.
This is the team that's going to take down the most dangerous wizard in over a century. A magizoologist, his indispensable assistant. A wizard descended from a very old family, a school teacher. A muggle.
Dumbledore asked that I give you something, Jacob.
Are you kidding me right now?
Who wouldn't like our chances?
Even that blurb I read was just complete nonsense. It's just a whole bunch of, like, argle-bargle speech. But that's all part of the wizarding world of Harry Potter from J.K. Rowling. Now, what's interesting about this is the Fantastic Beasts movies, I've kind of been fascinated with them because on one hand, I love the concept of it. I love the idea that we are going outside of Hogwarts. And even in the first movie, I think we go completely out of Hogwarts. We go back to the Hogwarts school in the second movie. And in this third one, you show up there quite a few times because that's where Dumbledore hangs out. And it's not a movie that takes place at Hogwarts. And as much as I loved the Harry Potter movies, I thought those were fantastic. At a certain point, you were just focusing on a bunch of kids at a school when really the story was much bigger than that. And so I like the opening up of the world, the wizarding world as a whole, like globally, because it doesn't even take place in England. The first film takes place in New York. And this one, they jump around places, like parts of it are in Germany and part of it, they go to other countries. So it's bigger, much, much bigger than Hogwarts and bigger than Britain. I went back and rewatched the first two Fantastic Beasts movies. They're available on HBO Max if you've got subscriptions for that, or you can watch it on Peacock. Now, Peacock, if you have the NADS version, you're going to get ads in it. So that's why I watched them on HBO Max. But, you know, I realized I felt about the same way in rewatching them because I hadn't seen either of them since the movies came out in theaters, you know, several years ago. And it's funny, if they had started developing this now, because they got like five movies planned, if they were developing it now, this would have totally been a series on HBO Max. Because if you look at the first two films, it's just a lot of world building. I can't even blurb the first two films very well. It's about this guy who's kind of running around New York looking for monsters that escaped his magical suitcase. I mean, that's like the first movie's plot. The second movie is, well, this bad wizard escapes and has a rally at the end. I mean, there's not much of a plot to these movies. It's all background and setup. And it's fascinating because it gives you a rich tapestry of this world beyond Hogwarts. And I love that idea. I'm irritated that the first couple films didn't have much of a plot. This one has more of a plot to it. And that's a huge plus because in this one in particular, they're directly trying to make sure that Grindelwald does not get elected King of the Wizards or whatever that title would be. They don't want him to rise to power. And that's ultimately the drive of the film. You know, it does open itself up for two more movies, but we've had diminishing returns in the box office. And part of that's because these movies are so expensive to put together, which I think they could dial back on the production on these. That's why I think it would have been more interesting ultimately if this were a series on TV, because, you know, you compare something like, and this is a very different cut from the different cloth, but Peacemaker, I think, is a much more successful series than, as much as I love the Suicide Squad movie, Peacemaker is more successful than the Suicide Squad is as a piece of entertainment. Plus the fact David Yates is directing, and he directed the last couple Harry Potter movies, and he's directed all of these Fantastic Beasts movies. And David Yates had cut his teeth directing for the BBC, doing long-form storytelling over multiple episodes of television. But with the exception of some real murky cinematography, which I do have to say, I'm getting tired of unlit things. I mean, I know they're wizards and they love their candles, but my God, buy a lamp or learn how to light something or shoot something during the day. You know, things tend to be very gray in these movies. And that just seems to be a thing that's going on with the cinematography today. So that's frustrating. But overall, I mean, I think there's more of a story here. There's a little bit more character development. There's a relationship, as they talk about, and I'm sure you've read about it in the press, about the relationship between Dumbledore and Grindelwald. And it takes some of the characters and some of the things that started out in the first couple films and brings them to a head. So I actually enjoyed this. Of the three, I think this is the best Fantastic Beasts movie. But I'm looking for more. And to the point of Mads Mikkelsen taking over for Johnny Depp to play Grindelwald. Johnny Depp's got his own little problems right now with some legal problems and divorce problems. And, you know, he's got some image problems right now. So they got Mads Mikkelsen to star as Grindelwald. And what's interesting is Mikkelsen does not do anything at all like what Johnny Depp did. He doesn't dress the same. He doesn't look the same. He doesn't try to evoke that. And he kind of makes it his own. And I think, and I can respect that. I still think what they did with the film is pretty good. So I'm going to have to say The Fantastic Beasts, The Secret of Dumbledore, definitely worth seeing. Better than the other two. I'd say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Cellar. This is available on Shudder. It just dropped this week. A family moves into a remote Irish house only to have their daughter go missing in what appears to be a demonic haunting.
What's in there?
That's the cellar.
Ellie!
Ellie!
We've talked to her friends, but no leads, unfortunately.
Something happened in the cellar. What about this?
It's definitely a representation for a dimension.
There's symbols above all the doors. An ancient evil.
There's something in there. It looks like Ellie.
This is a very basic haunted house type movie. And it follows a sort of a setup that we've seen a lot, where you've got a family that got this house for a steal. Well, you know, when you get such a nice place for a steal and it's fully furnished and everything and it costs almost nothing, there's a reason for that. Maybe the house is haunted. So we've seen this going all the way back to stuff like the Amityville Horror. And the idea is that there's this cellar that seems to, at times, open up to somewhere else, you know, to maybe another dimension or something. And when the daughter goes missing, because she goes down the cellar, they don't know where she went. You know, of course, the police aren't going to be like, oh, it must be demons, you know. So the mother, played by Alicia Cuthbert, who's best known from like 24, she played Jack Bauer's daughter. She's not Irish, but the rest of the cast, the film's an Irish film. They have another kid, it was a son, and they want to protect him. Now, like any horror movie, there's a lot of stupid pills being consumed by the characters. I mean, look, if you have a cellar in your house and it's creepy and potentially dangerous, I would move a wardrobe in front of that. I would not leave the door unimpeded. I would put all of my spare boxes I haven't packed yet. I would park a car in front of the door just to stop people from going down there. And then there's another door in the house that's like to the boys' room, and he almost gets sucked down. And I'm like, well, you know, I would close that too. I mean, you don't have closet space. Fine. Buy a wardrobe with all the money you saved and put it in front of that door. So there's a lot of dumb behavior that is used to propel the horror elements of the story. And that's somewhat forgivable. It's annoying, but it's forgivable in this context. When it finally gets rolling, when it finally starts to explore what it is, it gets very interesting. It reminds me a little bit of the Insidious movies, where there's something to be explored in the other world. And it's more than just a ghost floating around the house. And I think that's neat. I think it has a good payoff. And even though there's elements of the story throughout that are cliche and overdone and very familiar, it has a freshness to it that it kept my eye. So this is available exclusively on the Shudder streaming service, and I'm going to have to say that The Cellar kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Roar and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Spider-Man No Way Home. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews with another property from Apple TV Plus, Roar. This series tells eight separate stories about everyday struggles of women brought to life in literal reality.
It's Mommy's first day back to the office this week.
I don't want you to go. Don't go.
Ta-da!
Wow. Is it for your golf trophies?
It's for you.
They're turning your book into a movie.
I wish I felt less itchy about it.
Make the most of this.
I don't understand why you guys aren't answering any of my questions.
Good marriage without even knowing what it will be like.
You could return him.
And what's the reason for returning your husband?
Where to start?
Before I even start reviewing this, I have to just acknowledge the elephant in the room or the fat guy in the room. I am a dude. I am not a woman. I'm 100% a cis-hetero man. And I am now going to review a feminist piece of work. So take that with a grain of salt, because I do not know what it's like to be a woman. And I can only imagine from what I've heard or talked to, but that's what I do. I review things. And so Roar, it's based on a book that is also a group of short stories. And this actually has a really good cast. Nicole Kidman's in the production behind it, but she also stars in an episode. You've got other stars in there, like Judy Davis is in there. You've got Alison Brie. You've got Issa Rae. There's quite a few recognizable names in the series. And each episode starts off relatively pragmatic. It's a normal, everyday life story. But then there's some element to it that's thrown in there that it's either surreal or maybe a bit of bizarro fiction where things get very literal. Like in the story, the very first one stars Issa Rae as a woman who has published a book and Hollywood is wooing her to make a movie out of it. When she goes out there and she's talking to the studio, suddenly they act as if she doesn't talk and doesn't exist and nobody sees her, and it's about her turning invisible. There's another one where Nicole Kidman plays a woman who starts to eat photographs in a photo album as she's going through some old memories, and it's allowing her to flash into the memories. And as good as the acting is and as good as the production is, some of these things are just so on the nose. They're the equivalent of Jimmy Fallon laughing at his own jokes on Saturday Night Live. They lose any sort of creative energy because they're so obvious. I like the one with Issa Rae, you know, it's the woman who is invisible. Well, okay, sometimes women feel invisible. And I mean, maybe I'm not interpreting these right. Maybe I'm just taking them way too literally, and maybe there's something more to it that I'm not catching, but it just seems to be a literal interpretation of what some women face in the world. You know, some women feel like they're invisible. Some women probably feel like, even though they should be the one who absolutely should be consulted, nobody's listening to. And there's another one which has a woman who's basically a fashion model. Her husband builds a shelf for her, and she just sits on the shelf all day. I mean, it's literally putting her on the pedestal, and it's her trying to escape and what she does when she gets off the shelf. And that's just so, it's so on the nose. I mean, there's nothing to dissect or understand in the movie. It's all right out there in the front. Now, there's a couple of them that are interesting, that even borderline more on bizarro. There's one that Rashida Jones directs it, and it's about a woman who gives birth, and she's struggling with going back to work at this company where she's an executive, and she feels guilt about not being at home with her kids. And so she starts seeing bite marks showing up around her body. Well, you know, obviously it's the gnawing guilt at her and everything. And eventually, by the end of it, they kind of explain it, and that's a problem. But Rashida Jones manages to put together a kind of a grisly body horror episode, which is one of the first ones of all of them I saw. I was like, wow, that actually, it's not perfect, but it's way better than the other ones in there. And there's one where a woman falls in love with a duck, which is weird. But again, it's meant to be symbolic, but it's so obvious they hit you over the head with it. And that's my biggest problem, is that it doesn't allow itself to have any level of subtlety. It is all in your face. And at that point, it loses its entertainment value, or it loses its artistic value by explaining itself too much. So there, I just finished mansplaining Roar to everybody. So, you know, take that with a grain of salt. Like I said, cis-hetero man here reviewing a feminist piece of fiction. So, I don't know. I thought it kind of sucked.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's big release is Spider-Man No Way Home. I'm sure you've heard of that movie. Made over $800 million in the domestic box office. After his secret identity is revealed by Mysterio, Peter Parker gets Doctor Strange to cast a spell that goes wrong and splits open the multiverse.
When Mysterio revealed my identity, my entire life got screwed up.
I was wondering if maybe you could make it so that he never did.
Strange.
Don't cast that spell. It's too dangerous.
We tampered with the stability of space-time. The multiverse is a concept about which we know frighteningly little. Be careful what you wish for, Parker.
This was interesting to rewatch. I'd only seen it once, and that was during its initial release, actually before it came out, when I watched the press screening back in December. And I really liked it then. And then it became this phenomenon. It did unprecedentedly well. It did way more box office than I thought it would. But I think it deserved it. It's a fun movie. Is it a great movie? I know there's a huge debate going around. Is this a good movie? It's a good movie. Is it a great movie? Well, you know, it pushes the buttons. It does what it needs to do. It does the crossover elements to it. By now, everybody knows that they pull in all these characters from the previous films, including the Amazing Spider-Man films and then the original Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies. So it's neat to see it without worrying about spoilers. But it's as enjoyable and as fun and as effervescent as it was when I saw it the first time, you know, several months ago. So it works well on home video, and you know, it's good. It's interesting to look at it where it's going, especially with the special feature. The special features are the most interesting part of this movie, because what they do is they reveal what the intent and the idea for this series was. And there certainly is this subtext in all of these discussions and interviews, especially with Amy Pascal, who is trying to become the next Jerry Bruckheimer for Sony Pictures, because she's putting her face all over this thing. And, you know, she's interviewed in half the behind the scenes stuff, but they talk about it being the final Spider-Man. This might be the end. This is no longer going to be involved in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That, of course, were stuff that they recorded before it became one of the biggest movies of all time. But see, I don't know whether Marvel Studios Disney is going to be playing ball, because the only reason Spider-Man's back and was able to make this much money was the connection to Doctor Strange and the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Yeah, they tied it into the other Spider-Man movies, but they couldn't have done it so seamlessly without Doctor Strange and the Avengers connection. And there's been stories in the past where Sony's like, well, you know, we still want to do this with Spider-Man. We don't want to pay you any money for this, but we want you guys to put your Marvel magic on it. And especially now that this movie did unprecedentedly well, and a movie like Morbius is kind of flopping at the box office, and that movie has a bunch of multiverse Easter eggs to it. So, I mean, I'll be curious to see what happens with Spider-Man, because I have a feeling that, like, Kevin Feige and Marvel Studios is going to be like, look, we don't need Spider-Man. We've got everybody else. And that's great that this movie did so well, but you did not do this on your own. This involved some of our juju going on, and so we should get equal pay. So I think they're going to fight over Spider-Man. You're going to have a huge epic fight in the studios over the Spider-Man, and I think they teased that unexpectedly in the special features. But the special features actually have a good amount. You know, one of the complaints I have with some DVDs and Blu-rays that come out now is they don't have much special features, but this one does. This is like 90 minutes of special features. It's got interviews, it's got special effects and stunt things. They do get a little bit self-congratulatory. I mean, they have one about Tom Holland, they have one about the director. And, you know, if I had to hear the crew gush about how great everybody is, it does get a little bit much. And you expect that with these behind-the-scenes things, but you just can't do that with every single one. So the behind-the-scenes thing could be a little more diverse in terms of what they're showing, but there's enough content in there that you can spend a chunk of time watching that. So I enjoyed it. I liked this new Spider-Man movie. I like the fact that they're pulling away from the tech that he had in the Tony Stark costume, which if they continue the Spider-Man universe, and if they recast it, and they just do it under the radar of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and just make their own Sonyverse, that's cool too. I wouldn't mind just going back to the good old-fashioned Spider-Man who didn't have a suit that was basically a spider version of Iron Man. So I'm going to have to say Spider-Man No Way Home totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it. I need to go. Next week I'm going to be talking about The Northman. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.